quand je me suis éveillé, j'ai senti une affreuse tristesse. J'étais dans ma chambre, dans mon lit. Et pourtant, je me sentais en terre étrangère, oubliée, solitaire. Ce même matin, on m'a rappelé ce que j'avais eu le temps d'oublier pendant les années de pouvoir soviétique. J'étais une juive. Des Allemands passaient dans des camions en criant « Juden kaputt !»
Welcome to Wiseman Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Glynnis, and I'm here with my co-host, Arlen Golden. How are you doing, Arlen?
Hey, Sean. I'm doing good. All things considered. Got a working reading here. No, I don't. That would be a weird one. I'm good. You're good.
I am. You know, I had a special opportunity last weekend to Ann Arbor Film Festival, which you're familiar with.
Of course.
I think one of the country, maybe the oldest or most
prestigious avant-garde mm-hmm. film fest in North America, I believe they say.
And it's all short format. And I try to go every year to at least see one program. And I went to one of the juror programs this year, which was by Wenhua Sha. And he showed 9 of his films in a program. Most of them were on 35 or 16 millimeter, which was nice. But what piqued my interest and why I'm talking about it here is because he, the sort of like centerpiece of the program is a film of his from like 2021, I think, called Concrete Boston City Hall, mm-hmm. which, you know, sounds pretty familiar for listeners of this program. But he calls it something of like a extension to, not quite a reaction to, but, you know, sort of in play, in conversation with Frederick Wiseman's City Hall. And Wenhua is, he's, I don't know where he lives now, but he's spent time in Boston, lived there for a while, if he doesn't now. But so, you know, as a local, and it was really interesting to see this film, which was like 20 minutes long, about the actual building, City Hall. So it's like there's very few actual people in it, and he shot it like during COVID, and so after Wiseman was there. And it's sort of like this sort of polar opposite of what Wiseman's film is, not only in length, but also, you know, the look at like the material physical place. And I had a brief chance to talk to him and sent him some questions for a follow-up about the film. And I haven't gotten responses back, but I hope that I do, because it would be great if we are able to talk about it when we get to City Hall in a while. But, you know, he's familiar with Wiseman, knows some of his people and stuff like that. It was a cool little surprise to see something so close to what we do here on the program.
Cool. Yeah. No, Ann Arbor, of course, is rad. I was certainly in Wiseman City Hall struck by that sort of giant brutalist, you know, concrete mm-hmm. structure, used imaginatively on the poster as like what, like a Jaws mouth
shark,
situation. Mm-hmm. Absent even of the context and relationships you're talking about, you know, just as like I could see enjoying a formalist experimental film just kind of about, you know, the structure of City Hall.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super interesting. I won't spoil any of it, 'cause, I imagine by the time we get to City Hall, like next year, we'll be able to hopefully see it, and talk mm-hmm. about it. But, cool. But yeah. We're here today to talk about, Wiseman's 2002 film The Last Letter, which is his second of 3 fictional works to date. A film that he shot in 3 weeks and edited in less than 3 months from 12 hours of rushes. So
certainly a different situation than we're used to.
Indeed. And I wanted to go through, we don't have a guest today. So me and Arlen are going to carry you home on this one. But, I kind of wanted to go through, you know, a little bit of background.
I wonder if there are any, like, real last letterheads that we missed the opportunity with.
Letterheads.
Doubt it.
Yeah, that would be funny. You can email us if you want. Oh, you know what I wanted to say, actually, before we get started? Thanks to Maurice Dormant, the critic who wrote the book American Chronicles, the French book on Wiseman that we've talked about a little bit here. You know, he has sources, and I think we may have brought this up before, but he has different sources than, you know, Barry Keith Grant and Carolyn Anderson and Thomas Benson, because some of them are French. And it's been cool to find some of those things and just find about the existence of some of those. And one of which that I was looking at today that he cites from is a book, I can't remember his name. It's Philippe Pilade or something like that. And he wrote this French book from, I want to say it's the 90s. I could be wrong, but...
looked like it from the cover you sent me.
Yeah, and it's called like Chronicler of the Western World, I believe is the translation. But he calls it like an essential like working tool for Wiseman heads and scholars. And you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, you wish you could crack open and actually understand. I asked my wife, who speaks a couple of languages, how long she thought it would take for me to understand French, you know, well enough to be able to translate this book. And she said, I'd probably have to dedicate like four years. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay. I was about to get excited.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm quitting my job, going back to school. No, but so if there are any like, you know, people out there that feel as, you know, zealous about Wiseman studies and can speak French. But otherwise I was like, you know, I might have to find a workaround, even if it's just like, using some sort of AI translator and going by hand and like trying to figure this shit out. But, it just seems like such a awesome text that we can't use.
Yeah. I mean, and we know it's also not the only one. There's a Japanese, yeah, like Wiseman study. It's looks pretty thick. And I believe it's called like Documenter of the United States, or Frederick Wiseman Recording United States, something along those lines. It's $100 and it's all in Japanese. So yeah, any good Samaritans out there want to spend the time and money to translate that for us,
or start a pool? We'll pitch in. We'll start. Yeah, maybe we should spearhead something like that. The French one is out of print as well, but it's only like $50, like $45-$55, so it's not crazy. Mm-hmm, but anyway, it's just kind of, you know, but it's, you know, as much as it's like, man, I wish we had that, it's something to look forward to perhaps happening down the line. Who knows?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just interesting, I guess, to see. I remember the first time I interviewed him, asking him if, you know, he considered himself to be like anthropological or ethnographic filmmaker in any sense, you know, and he said no in so many words, basically. But you know, I would think from these non-American national context, you know, it might seem much more that way,
for sure,
you know,
for sure.
like what is life in America, mm-hmm, through these decades. So I would love to see that reflected back to us, you know, in English if possible. But
yeah, for sure. Okay, so on the last letter, I wanted to give like a bit of background on the author of the text itself, and sort of Wiseman's interaction with the text as we get into the film. So the last letter is a chapter from Vasily Grossman's 1959 novel called Life and Fate, which I hear is a pretty chunky 800-page book or something. And Grossman was a Ukrainian Jew, and he was rejected for military service in 1941. So he became a correspondent for a Soviet military paper and spent about 1,000 days on the front lines. And he is credited as one of the first journalists to write about the genocide of people in Eastern Europe. And the last letter is kind of Grossman imagining what his mother might have written him had she composed a letter before being marched by the German occupiers to a mass grave. And Wiseman encountered this text for the first time in Paris, apparently, sometime after 1980, and in a public reading given by a woman and her husband, and at a theater. And here's a quote about that from an interview from Wiseman. "What precipitated it was that I walked by a theater in Montparnasse years ago where these actors were reading the chapter. It sounded interesting from the blurb outside the theater, and I went in and I was immediately taken by the text. I went out and bought the novel. It's a subject for all the obvious reasons that I've always been interested in. I was born in 1930, and as a child, I remember hearing Hitler on the radio, and when the war started, I followed it closely and read widely about Germany and Russia. One thing that, little sidebar here, but it's kind of funny that he came into knowledge of this text born out of curiosity, which is like, you know, such a his method as a filmmaker. It's just like seeing things and following his nose. But like everyone else, Wiseman was only able to read Life and Destiny when it came out, probably in the United States, like around 1985, and has often expressed his admiration for the book and the author. And he created in 1988 his first theatrical exhibition or adaptation of the chapter. And that was done at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then the film ran out of competition in Cannes in 2002. And the last stage production of it was in 2003 in New York City, and where it was with a new actor, Kathleen Chalfant, an American actor. So I think I just wanted to kind of set this up that I think it may be possible if you're sort of like a budding Wiseman head and you're just kind of like making your way through his films one by one on Canopy or whatever, like many of us do, it may be easy to see this as kind of a curio that Wiseman made, a sort of like one-off where he tries to like flex some new cinematic muscle. And while there is some truth to, you know, you might call it a curio and him flexing some new muscle, the reality is that this is a piece of literature and performance that was with Wiseman for more than 15 years. You know, it's clearly a very important piece for him personally, and he's quoted in Darmon's book saying that making this film was one of the greatest experiences of his professional life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll just add he was, after making La Comédie Française, he was invited to stage or direct a play by the administration, and he, like, without hesitation chose this, and it was on the success of that production that he was able to raise the funds to make it a film. But, you know, some of the reviewers will discuss, have differing opinions about this, but I would be on the side, and which I think is the right side, and the side that Wiseman advocates for, is like, you know, this is far from being merely a filmed performance of a stage play.
Yeah,
you know,
this
is, you know, a purely a work of cinema. You know, certainly it's very actorly and sparse, and dealing with heavy themes, but you know, without a lot of naturalistic settings or anything. But it's
although I think that's how it started, right? His first production of it was like realistic.
Right, but this as a film is none of those things. You know, he, it's very much reliant on lighting, on editing, on composition, on, you know, the marrying of visual material to the dialogue being spoken. It seemed like a few of the writers certainly attested their patience, and as I think the more it reminded them of theater, but I think those who were able to pick up on and engage on a cinematic wavelength seem to get much more out of it.
For sure. So the film starts one actor, Catherine Samy, who is from, she was the doyenne of La Comédie Française, and she's still with us. She's 91 currently. And the last time we saw her on this program was she was speaking at a fellow actor's 100th birthday party in La Comédie Française, the film. But one of the big things with The Last Letter for Wiseman's career, and I didn't know this until after the film, at the end of the film, that this is a different DP for right. Did you know that going in?
No, in fact, yeah, in one of my notes, I was like, oh, Davey's really cooking.
So it's the cinematographer is Georgios or Yorgos Arvanitis, who is a Greek cinematographer, shot many great films with Teo Angelopoulos, like Landscape in the Mist and The Beekeeper and Ulysses Gaze, a ton of them, and as well as Catherine Bigelow films like Fat Girl and Anatomy of Hell and Romance. So it's really wild that, like, you know, to get this European cinematographer, and I mean it totally works, but I have no idea what the decisions were there, or if David was unable to do it, or what have you, or that wasn't in the cards. But I wonder how.
I would assume he was simply unavailable, only because he shot Serafina he shot a couple,
I wonder how funding differs for a film like this, if it does for him.
It was probably easier because he was working with French institutions, I would imagine. Yeah. And, you know, I clock Canal Plus as one of the funders, Arte, you know, so like pretty, you know, relatively household names if you have any knowledge of French cinema, but like, you know, let alone La Comédie Française, which I think was involved as well. So, you know, and whatever funding was drummed up, you know, I guess you could say it's on the screen, right? Because it probably was not the most expensive production.
Yeah.
You know, only a few, relatively few technicians involved, at least for, you know,
craft services
film.
For four.
Yeah, right. And what it was, two, 3 week shoot.
Yeah,
something like that. Yeah.
So I was thinking about how to group the film as like Wiseman chroniclers. I think there's a few different ways that we can think about it and talk about it. But one, obviously, as a film about performance, a theme that has taken on many faces throughout his career. Another way of looking at it is thinking about it as a film about violence. Themes about the variety of violence embedded into our society. Throughout his career, I wrote something after I saw it briefly about how it, you know, is once again related to meat, a thing that we find sort of the center of the constellation of his work. But also, you know, it came out in the same year as Domestic Violence 2 and right after Domestic Violence 1. So it's very much about violence, even though it looks very different from those films.
Mm. Yeah, no doubt it must have been, you know, swirling in his head in the midst of that, you know, diptych, those ideas. So like but he, you know, Barry Keith Grant categorized it, I think, the first way you were describing it, as, you know, with the dance films and the art films. Weissman himself seems to talk about it more in the second way you were categorizing it, considering, you know, violence and power relations and social control of individuals.
There's a couple other groups. One is obviously fiction films of his, as sure. I mentioned, second of three. And then the other way would be sort of like art and culture. Like, it sort of fits in with like his dance films and La Comédie Française, a couple, National Gallery, yeah, and many plus here, as films, I think, that are reflective of his interest in arts and culture.
Which also overlaps, I think, with maybe a European category. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
of films.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, most of his European films are about arts and culture, but you can also throw in Maneuver in there for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So to kind of expand the, you know, the European context some.
And I think it's interesting to think about The Last Letter alongside a couple. They're both epistolary works from the POV of one woman, and they're both about family. It's interesting that his last two fictional works are focused on family, something he doesn't really talk a lot about otherwise. Barry Keith Grant makes the smart point that in both films he talks a lot about sort of them in conjoined, and he makes the smart point that the women feel as though their identity is threatened, which is a theme that he finds consistent with some of his nonfiction work, like In Jackson Heights and Crazy Horse. But they're also interesting to think about formally. Like I said, it's like a filmmaker who's, you know, flexing some new muscles. Like, he's clearly interested and curious about the form in ways that aren't suited to his nonfiction work.
Sure.
They're kind of opposites, yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, well... both yes and no, I guess. Like, and for also, you know, you could say Serafita's diary, you know, is a sort of monologue of written material,
for sure.
Or at least, you know, diegetically speaking. But you know, the if we're talking about formalism, you know, Barry Keith Grant, I thought, was smart to note the emphasis on hands here, mm-hmm, and he related it, I think, to a scene, mm-hmm, you know. And if we're talking about another interest or category of films, you know, religion certainly is a part of all this. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, we read this one French academic piece that, you know, was a bit involved and, you know, very focused on like acting semiotics and had diagrams and things of that nature. But one thing that I thought it did that was pretty interesting was look at how Samy was filmed talking about what she was talking about in La Comédie Française, and a scene in The Last Letter with Samy where similar themes are being evoked in the dialogue, and Weissman is visually representing them in like similar ways. So I thought that was pretty interesting and instructful. Maybe, you know, in the Socialist Website interview, I think he's talking about sort of this intuition and, you know, unconscious artistry involved in his work. And, you know, you can imagine maybe like, okay, when I'm hearing somebody talk about feeding the elderly or, you know, taking care of community, I'm going to focus on somebody's face or hands, you know, in more of a pointed way, because, you know, there are natural associations there of assistance and of bringing food to your mouth and, you know, things of that nature that maybe it's just, you know, part of his wiring to associate that and represent it visually that way.
Yeah. And speaking, you mentioned the World Socialist Website interview, which was at TIFF. It's funny that, I mean, it's kind of a painful interview, but the interviewer asks, he's like, I'm not familiar with your fiction work. And Weissman's like, well, it's besides, and experimental work. It's just this, which is really funny. Yeah. Like, just will not talk about Serafita's. And obviously it's...
Yeah, writers seem to alternate between calling this his first and his second fiction film.
Yeah, most say first. And I guess, like, you know, it's not mentioned on, like, Zipporah, you know, .com. Not that... I mean, I don't think people were using Zipporah.com in 2002, but just, like, I mean, that's, like... That is symptomatic of the way that he's treated it as something that he kind of disowns. But anyway, it's just funny to see him actually acknowledge it, but, you know, in such a oblique way. And yes, so talking kind of like formally, like, with a couple, this is, you know, that one thing that I think is really interesting in comparing them is a couple is, like, you know, you have this character who's, you get to see her in her milieu, and, or not necessarily milieu, but her environment and landscapes and, like, her house and stuff. And here, this is, you know, it's all chiaroscuro and abstracted. And, and I think that's makes a big difference. I mean, that's also reflective of, like, the sound we hear in the film, or don't hear in this film, and how, you know, a couple is also, like, it's abstract in its own way, obviously, but it's mixed with a certain sort of naturalism in a strange way.
Yeah, you could make a case for it being kind of a formal bridge between Serafita and a couple, you know, like towards a couple's naturalism and Serafita's, you know, kind of more expressed experimental formalism. But, you know, I think that those formal elements are really kind of what made this film pop for me. You know, it's something I wasn't particularly excited to get into, being, you know, not a doc and one person talking for an hour about their experiences during the Holocaust. You know, it's not the most enticing prospect, for film viewing, especially if you're, you know, really just energized by Weissman's documentary output. But, you know, I'll say, I guess, I don't know if enjoy is, like, the appropriate word, but I did enjoy it more than I anticipated I might going into it. And I think it was, you know, the cinematography, the Weissman's rhythmic editing, I think you really can clock. There are a few points where it felt like, oh, this is, like, the same rhythm as one of the pillow sequences, you know.
Interesting.
You could kind of sense that in the cut. There's a certain faster pace to it that I associate with those.
So what you're saying is, and, overall, that you typically don't like listening to a woman talk for an hour. Like, that premise was not interesting to you.
Well, I can't talk back, so yeah.
Okay.
No, I was, yeah, all too happy to sit my ass down and listen to Catherine Samy in the end, because, you know, I think Rap Fogel in CinemaScope was the harshest on this film and called her performance showy. But, you know, she's got a lot on her shoulders for the success of this film, you know, and I think her performance is captivating, and, you know, the film lives or dies on it. So it gives the viewer something to hold on to, because, you know, it's a monologue. Again, you know, no set, no music, little context, no interaction, so, except between her and the viewer. So I don't know what else you know, this isn't a place for something that's particularly reserved, I guess, or
right.
And it's an emotional piece, right? It's heavy, you know, and I think, again, coming right off of Domestic Violence, which we were calling, you know, his most empathetic or most grounded in emotion, you know, these are muscles that he has been flexing, you know, and I think are readily translated into this work.
I wanted to say quickly, before we get too far away from the formalism, something that he says in the NPR interview. So there, you know, there have been audio interviews with NPR for the last few Weissman films, but never accessible on the website. But this one, thankfully, was. And he talks about trying it out in the late 80s on stage in this more realistic manner, but it didn't work. And he said the more like impressionistic aesthetic made sense to him. Part of that is because he said as an adolescent, you know, like I said earlier in the quote, that he was kind of following along, but he would go to the movies on Saturday afternoons and just see like black and white news footage of World War II. So his memory of this time in history and what happened and what was happening in Europe is just tied to black and white images.
Right. Which, you know, I think, I don't think it's like impossible to imagine this being a color film, but you know, some of these shots, thinking about like a lot of the time with the shadows in the background, we have a gray background with darker shadows on it. But a lot of the time the background is like pitch black, you know, and her dress is black. And it's almost like this Méliès effect where she appears with this like floating head. Mm-hmm. And hands, you know, and nothing else as her dress kind of is subsumed into the blackness of the background. You know, that's an effect that probably wouldn't have worked in color, certainly. And, you know, talking, of course, about like all the connotations of the shadows and the way that those are employed in the film, you know, probably wouldn't have worked the same as well. You know, would color have opened the door to other formal possibilities? Certainly. But I mean, you know, talking about death.
Like in Serafita.
Do you think that's like the main reason why Serafita? Yeah.
Okay. Part of this, you know, you're talking about these close-ups, which are very striking. A few different people, including Scott Tobias of the AV Club, mentioned Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc, which is sort of unavoidable comparison. And something, you know, it also it makes me think about Crimes of the Future stuff from a couple of years ago, the Cronenberg film. And some of the close-ups on Viggo Mortensen there are in black and white are also very like expressive. And do you know if this was shot on film or digital?
It's 35.
Okay. For some reason, maybe it was just the canopy thing or just like, it looked a little digitally.
For sure. I think, this is one I'm looking forward to being restored for sure. But I think I read in one of the things about the funding was like the French funding came through to be able to shoot on 35, which is, you know, rare for Reisman, who shoot up until this point was shooting on 16. So.
I agree. What did you kind of like make of the discourse overall, like the critical discourse?
I mean, mostly, you know, you could call it surprisingly fawning, you know, seemed like someone like, the writer in Variety, for instance, you know, this isn't, for the, publication that's always saying, you know, no commercial prospects, you know, you think the commercial prospects for something like this are fairly scant.
Maybe, you know, Variety was just like, oh, thank God he finally found an editor.
If it was 15 minutes shorter, maybe it would have even been more effusive. But like, you know, they were using words like magnificent, I think, you know, typical kind of an epic of the imagination.
I was thinking about what that response means for something like Variety, because and I think overall with some of the other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there's a sense like, with something like this that comes off as, you know, it's very theatrical and it's very sort of rooted, like I said, in sort of this like, interest in arts and culture, mm-hmm. in sort of like a, you know, high art type of way that I think, and it's also about something that is like the subject matter is obviously like something that's very widely respected, that it, I think it's something that like, it gets sort of the automatic respect because he's a name and because of the subject matter, and they go, oh, okay, it's interesting. And it might not be for me, but that's more about the form of what this is, rather than like an indictment of what the actual film is. Whereas like when it's just one of his documentaries and mm-hmm. it's like, okay, well I should be able, like I should like this. This is for everybody. And then you come away being like cold on it and you're like, well, maybe he should have like tightened it up.
Yeah. I mean, I do think the subject matter probably carries a lot of water here. And I think we can imagine this sharing some theater space with The Pianist coming out around the same time.
Was that 2002?
2002, yeah.
Oh.
So, you know, something in the air, Life is Beautiful would have been, a little before.
Did you listen to the NPR one interview?
No, I didn't miss that.
It's really funny. There's a moment. I mean, it's very brief and... it's like only like 4 or 5 minutes of actual interview. And Robert Siegel is like, he's talking about the length and he goes, you know, it might not be the length that lends itself to a cinematic experience. And Wiseman starts laughing. And he's like, well, you know, I hope you're able to see it in a cinema. So I don't know how much it played outside of, you know, festivals in the actual cinema.
Well, he must have had a feeling of like, oh, well, now it's too short. You know, you're always telling me it's too long. Yeah, right. Well, we know it had a film forum run. That's where a lot of these reviews emerged from. 2 weeks at Film Forum, where it was paired with like this archival short, Jewish Life in Krakow. And I did find there was a Hartford theatrical run, Hartford, Connecticut, as well. And it was paired with an Indian short, the only directorial effort by the writer of Monsoon Wedding, I think, which I was unable to track down.
That sounded a little more tangentially related.
Right, for sure. Yeah, no doubt. But I mean, just speaks to that, 1 hour for a theater ticket might feel like you're not quite getting your money's worth. So I think theaters were conscious of that and when they slotted it.
We do get a J-Ro back in Chicago Reader, and so I think the three that I kind of focused on, before I do J-Ro, there was somebody in New York Magazine, Peter Rainier, who kind of is more on the very like laudatory wave that you're talking about, that a lot of them are. And he had like a good line about her hands being like having this lyric spidery expressiveness that one usually gets with great mimes or deaf performers. And I liked that review pretty well. But the ones that I kind of keyed in on that I took notes from were reviewers who were a little more like cold or sort of like not super one way or the other on it. Like Rosenbaum talks about how it's so well made that I can only feel guilty for not liking it more, which is funny. He says the text is vivid and powerful and the performance is riveting. Although the fancy configurations of expressionist shadow Wiseman employs throughout this black and white film suggest he felt the package needed something more. It does. A little more breathing room for the viewer. And I'm not sure exactly what he means by breathing room, but I also kind of get this sort of like nonplussed appreciation. I think that's kind of closer to where I fall, which is, I appreciate the expressiveness of it. But I think what I would benefit from, not only the restoration, but actually seeing this in a theater, would make a huge difference. Where, you know, it's like a dark room and you're just you and this one performer for an hour, an experience that's a little harder to replicate at home.
I can imagine, you know, that those really stark chiaroscuro contrasted shots, close-ups of her face, you know, dominating a whole wall of a theater in a dark room, you know, would further the immersion. You know, I found all that stuff very captivating, but you know, no doubt I'm not super steel-minded, you know, I found myself wandering and having to rewind a few times, you know, in my couple watchings, because, you know, she would say something and I would just go off on a mental tangent and, you know, lose the past couple minutes and have to catch up. So, like, but, you know, I guess to your point, the cooler reviews on this were probably some of the more thoughtful and well considered, you know, cool to negative reviews that we encounter for Weissman. I think because they're generally coming from folks who do appreciate his work overall, you know, so they're not particularly like vitriolic, you know, they're all coming from a place of admiration and respect. But you know, one that carries with it like disappointment about this film in particular.
Yeah, like Steve Weinberg, which I'm not sure where exactly to attribute the piece, but we saw a retrospective piece of him or of his in Art Forum in Belfast, when he talks about how the Weissman project began to lose complexity with Meat and Canal Zone. But here he talks about how this film is about community, like much of Weissman's recent work, but really says that any real connection to his work feels superficial. But on the silhouette work, he says, when Weissman cuts from these spectral forms to the inescapably present actress, he first reminds us of the dehumanizing of the Jews by their oppressors, who reduce them to expendables. And he also says that the silhouettes act to reproduce community. And there are other, like Mamber and Grant, and somebody else too, like has like really like smart things to say about sort of what the ways that the silhouette work can symbolize various extensions of Semi's character. But Weinberg is somebody who saw one of the stage productions, which he said was also very strange. It was, I think, the one in Cambridge. He said it was weird but moving, and so he's talking about sort of the difference between the film and the performance, and sort of like he said that the self-consciousness of Weissman's filmmaking creates this like distancing effect that doesn't allow you to be fully immersed in her performance, like with a stage production, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that point in particular was one I put a hard disagree on, just because, you know, again, I think her performance is what keeps the film grounded and a viewer engaged, you know. I think Weissman's, you know, you could call it self-conscious. I don't know how you would define that necessarily, but I think, again, that's what makes this a film, you know, not just a recorded theater. And you know, the silhouettes, we could talk about them in depth, but I mean, they're not just there, you know, they're being used in a thoughtful way. Like, just one example off the top of my head, she's talking about this sort of forced migration to the ghetto and this like marching of all the Jews in the community down the street.
Qu'il était triste, mon fils, mon chemin vers le ghetto moyenâgeux. Je traversais la ville où j'avais travaillé pendant 20 ans. J'ai vu des centaines de gens en marche pour ce maudit ghetto. La rue était blanche d'oreillers, de baluchons. On soutenait les malades. On portait le père paralytique du docteur Margoulis dans une couverture. Un jeune homme tenait une vieille dans ses bras.
You know, and while she's discussing this, we see probably more shadows than we see throughout the rest of the film, kind of overlapping one another, creating this mass against the gray screen, you know, so, you know, think a little harder, Weinberg, I think.
It's funny to think, you know, he says that self-consciousness of his filmmaking, it's interesting to see how people sort of characterize Weissman's filmmaking in different ways. Like, in Scott Tobias's review, his sentiments are pretty similar to Weinberg's, but he has this weird statement. Given Weissman's attachment to artlessness, It's surprising that he adds any flourishes to the last letter. They're all to its detriment because they call attention to themselves instead of seizing the moment more directly. Mm. And Wiseman, if anyone, should know the power of an unblinking camera. And I only, I only bring it up to call attention to sort of this like conventional wisdom or assumed idea that what Wiseman does regularly is artlessness. Right. You know, I think if I'm being charitable to Tobias, not that he would deserve that, maybe he means like affectlessness, but, yeah. But also like, it's just like Weinberg when he says, you know, he's talking about like, it's all to its detriment because they call attention to itself instead of seizing the moment more directly. What does that mean?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, I think...
Well, Weinberg, too, was the most resistant to drawing any relationship to his documentary work. You know, he's, like, trying to do so as purely, like, surface-level circumstantial stuff, which I think is ridiculous. You know, mm-hmm. the one category he called out we didn't really talk about up top is community films.
Right, right.
You know, Belfast being relatively recently in his output. But I think even to feel the need to deny that is to acknowledge that there's something to it, you know, because it's where the mind goes naturally. And, you know, we already covered that. But I don't know. It's like I don't know if people want it to be, if in the moment means something about spontaneity, you know. I think I was really interested in what Weissman said in one of the interviews about how they shot each sequence multiple times, a few different ways, you know, and that in the edit, he was able to sort of replicate this feeling of discovery that he has in the edit for mm-hmm. his documentaries, because he's sort of finding the scenes and the combinations of shots that'll make them work, which, you know, probably just fits his process better. Than like, you know, just like storyboarding it all out, and having it be like this, you know, predetermined thing.
For sure. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's still the same person making the movie.
Yeah.
You don't go, like, you don't turn into a different filmmaker just because you make something different.
And I mean, you know, Sami, as we were talking about, you know, had performed this time and time again on the stage in multiple productions over the years. She had to perform it multiple times a day on set throughout this production. You know, I think given that, and even if you didn't know that, I think her performance retains a sense of spontaneity to it, a sense of
she's seizing the moment,
her reaction to, you know, what she's saying in a way I felt was kind of naturalistic, at least.
You would say she's seizing the moment directly?
I would say she's, whatever that means, sure. I don't know. I think what I just said articulates that she is doing that more than just like throwing the phrase out there and so.
What did you think of the interview with her in the MoMA book?
Oh man, that was so fun. Like, yeah, it was. It seems like they have a really playful relationship, you know.
Yeah,
it was funny hearing her like talk about grabbing him by the ears and like telling him the movies are too long.
It's so funny. She talks about grabbing his ears, and then she talks about like how his eyes have like the are reminiscent of like what, like old like Italian paintings or something. I can't remember like characters in them, but the whites of his eyes and the way he looks up or something, it was very interesting.
Says his thought, the expression in his eyes approach the divine, something along those lines.
But she calls him a predator of humanity, something that the interviewer is like kind of unsure how to pin down, and she's just like, nice, he's just taking, he's, you know, humanity is in front of him, and he takes it and he uses it. But she also talks about seeing some of these horrors in real life when she was 8 years old, which is interesting. And another tidbit that I liked was her saying that apparently Wiseman brought her photos of James Stewart, Gary Cooper, and Cary Grant to use to look at, I think, as Vitya. That was
so like to address her performance towards, you know, imagine those sort of cool classic Hollywood leading men as her son. Which was interesting motivation to read into, but like you know, I thought the line to he's sometimes rather cruel, he goes ha 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 ha, laughs like the devil, and then right before talking, she says that right before talking about how Follies is her favorite. it's like his great masterpiece, you know, which is a bit contradictory just considering what, you know, his detractors say about Follies. But, you know, yeah, again, it just seems like they have like this warm personal relationship.
He clearly has a great affection for her as an actress.
Yeah, and we should note too, he directed her again in another play. It was a staging of Beckett's Happy Days, which sounds pretty cool. But you know, I don't want to belabor this in our discussion, but I'll note it because it bears saying, even though it's obvious, but she is one of those who calls out the obvious relationship to the situation in Palestine through this, you know, something that a few of the reviewers note. Weissman didn't explicitly say it, but you know, he talks about Bosnia and Sudan and the ready relationship, you know, to similar situations happening currently, you know, that this is something that is specific but also universal, which, you know, is characteristic of the docs as well.
Yeah. Not one of those was the World Socialist website interviewer asking him at the end, just without any sort of relationship to his work, what his thoughts about our current political situation and the war in Iraq. And he said that he said, you'll have to read my book on it.
And which he took at face value.
Yeah. They're like, what's the book? He goes, well, it's like, he said something like, it's coming after the book I'm writing on Toronto after being here for 3 days.
Yeah, having some fun with him.
Did you have, and I didn't have any other notes on contemporaneous discourse, so if you did, feel free.
I don't know, I mean, I guess the Rap Vogel piece I thought was an interesting one to wrestle with because he was so firmly down on it, but you know, the one critique in there that sort of resonated with me was just about Holocaust cinema sort of writ large, you know, that their attempts to depict, you know, this horrible atrocity without kind of truly unsettling the viewer, you know, kind of maintaining the comfort of the cinematic engagement, you know, which I thought was valid. But you know, there was something I think in this film that like felt a bit like there is sort of in a way, maybe some folks characterize the documentary as a bit of like a perfunctory educational thing happening. Like I found myself thinking of Titanic, the way like the narrative like takes you through like how the ship sank, you know.
Oh, sure.
Like the narrative that Simi is recounting here sort of takes you through the like historical facts of, you know, ghettoization and eventual extermination, you know, in a way that you know, can be readily applied, like, you know, in a Holocaust education setting, you know, for like junior high students or something like that.
I get that. I liked the, it's not quite contemporaneous, but I liked the Peace and Not Coming.org by Adam Balls. I don't know if you got to it, but he has I'll read this, and it's a little bit on the longer side, but it's important, I swear. He says, it's a constant, albeit endless debate, in the realm of observational documentaries, how much of what we see is the director's own stylistic choice, and how much results from the spontaneity of the moment? On the surface, the scenes that have made Wiseman famous, the force feeding in Titica Follies, the closing scene in Domestic Violence, Mr. Hirsch's rambling soliloquy at the end of Welfare, seem unplanned. Yet Wiseman's films have always stressed the routine of our society, even if secondarily. There are force feedings and instances of domestic violence and visits to the welfare office every day. What seems like spontaneous moments are, in fact, just bends in the circle of daily occurrences. The vicious cycle, as one woman in Welfare says, signified by the similarities between opening and closing shots in many of Wiseman's other films. Which is Wiseman's point. He could easily have used the letter of any historical figure and made a much more personal look at the Holocaust. Instead, by relying on the account of a fictional character, Wiseman is stressing the unending cyclicality of war and suffering, because the emotions expressed in Anna's letter are not bound to a real person. She acts as a figure whose words are applicable to almost all conflicts. Mm-hmm. I like this quote because I was thinking a lot of it when I recently wrote a primer for Wiseman on the Bleeding Edge Substack. Go check it out. But I wrote about the importance of specificity in Wiseman's nonfiction work, that he's not working with broad general, or not working towards broad generalizations, but working through the specific moments and situations of specific people's lives. And here, Balls in Not Coming is pointing out how Wiseman flips that for his fictional work. And he's working through a fictional account rather than a specific person's work in order to represent this broader population, which I wouldn't have put together as articulate as that, but I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I highlighted a part of that quote as well, the specifically the unending cyclicality of war and suffering. Again, you know, thinking about this coming in the midst of domestic violence and domestic violence mm-hmm. too, you know, for sure. that is what Domestic Violence One at least is all about, right? The cyclical nature of suffering and violence.
And we just watched a movie full of women talking about their specific trauma, and this is one like long example of that.
And yes, specificity and universality too. I think that's what came up for Sami in her interview, where she starts talking about Palestine, because she's talking about you know, the idea of mothers and children. You know, that is something that is universal, that everyone can understand in any context.
It's not a pro-Israel film.
Certainly not. No, I mean, you know, by speaking about the Holocaust, of course, you're not just speaking about the Holocaust. You're not even just speaking about, you know, situations that might be a direct analog in contemporary times like Palestine. You're speaking about just, again, globally, like domestic violence did, this the nature of like human aggression against one another. And it's like just unending cycle. You come away, we talked about with Sophie at the end of Domestic Violence, you know, kind of feeling a little hopeless, like not necessarily all for naught, but you know, where all we can do is sort of put a bandage on a flesh wound. You know, I think here you can have similar thoughts coming away from the end of the film, that like, okay, you know, this is an experience that happened nearly a century ago now, but it is something that sounds very familiar and contemporary mm-hmm. that is, you know, still happening
for sure. And I mean, the premise is very poignant, like this idea of this letter that doesn't exist, and what it would look like to somebody that you won't get to speak to again.
Which we should add, I guess, to your intro, that like he was sort of imagining his own mother writing mm-hmm. this letter to him, because he had, you know, during the sort of encroachment and rise of European fascism, like a lot of Jews in the Soviet Union, sort of, at least younger ones, migrated towards like urban centers in Russia. I think he was in Moscow, while, you know, often their families stayed in like the rural villages, you know, that would later, you know, experience the fates described in the film. So, but apparently he had an opportunity to sort of get her or bring his mother along in some way that, you know, ultimately didn't happen for one reason or another. So I think there's a bit of an exorcism of guilt too, because, you know, the Sami in the film, you know, has a section talking about, you know, imagining her son protecting her, you know, like from everything that's happening here. So you got to imagine there, you know, he was really working through some stuff probably when he was writing that.
Interesting. And I mean, like I said, it was 1959. So, you know, it wasn't that long after, but, you know, enough time, you know, to try and process it, I suppose.
Sure.
Do you have anything else?
You know, I guess maybe talking about just really quick, you know, sort of as a fall, you know, art house event release of the time that it, like as you mentioned, it premiered at Cannes out of competition and then it played at Toronto. You know, I thought the program notes for both of those were, you didn't catch those? Mm-hmm. They were on Cinephile from PFA, but I'll, you know, just talk about them briefly because I thought their distinct wordings were interesting. But in Cannes, they say that she has the realization that her Jewishness is more important to her than her Russian nationality or communist beliefs. And in TIFF, they say it forces each person to confront and define his or her own identity at the point of its very annihilation. Which I like much better than the Khan note, because I think, you know, the film to me is like she's talking about how she didn't even really consider herself Jewish. It's only by being perceived as Jewish that she sort of became aware of her identity. And, you know, yes, she does express sort of these romantic notions about like tradition and culture and things like that. But, you know, I think at the end, it still probably for her feels like a betrayal. You know, and that if she could, I don't want to say like disavow her Jewishness, but like, you know, she did not come to her own, the decision that her Jewishness is important to her and her, on her own, you know, it was sort of thrust upon her. So I liked the way that TIFF, put it instead, that people are defining their own identity. They're forced to confront and make that definition, you know, right before they're killed. Because, like, you know, if somebody is telling you you're so much one thing that they're going to kill you, you're going to be like, well, I guess, you know, there's probably some credence to that. You know, you internalize that to some degree. So, you know, I don't know if it's a French and Canadian difference. You know, obviously there's, as Weissman notes in one interview, you know, France has its own complicated history of anti-Semitism and collaboration as depicted in The Sorrow and the Pity. But, you know, yeah, just a last little interesting note.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate that. Well, you can find us at weissmanpodcast@gmail.com.
Sure. If you're listening to this when it drops and live in the Bay Area, I'm continuing that Doc Rep series. We have Hands on a Hard Body coming up Thursday, April 11th at Balboa Theater. Great doc mentioned on this show before. And if you are in the Mid-Atlantic region, I'll be in the Maryland Film Fest next month. My short's playing there again. Probably the last hurrah for that, or close to it. So thought I'd make the trick out, a trek. If you're going to be there, say hi. Would love to see you. Yeah, back to the nonfiction world, and the happy circumstances of Florida.
Yeah, we will see you soon with Domestic Violence Dos.
Thank you.
Lord.